legitimately it was a reasonable concern that the boat was going to sink, which happened to a lot of people.
On this race, a lot of boats sunk?
Yeah, there were actually some Coast Guard rescues.
Because of this race?
Yeah.
The rope is free!
What?
The rope is free!
Liam's fallen into a crevasse, and I immediately thought he's dead, or at least seriously hurt.
And my guts had been ripped out of my body and were being contained by my flight suit.
I know a mountain lion is on top of me.
Welcome to episode 6 of the Wildertainment Podcast. Today I have, I would say, one of the greatest storytellers on the face of my knowledge on this planet. We're going to dive into his own personal type of survival story today. Basically, he took a skiff from Washington to Alaska. I won't say more. But who is Josh Latuka? That's a pretty easy question to ask yourself. And I will describe as this. He was in rescue swimmer school with me in the Coast Guard. He was also a rescue boat driver in the Coast Guard. He's been a wildland firefighter. Thank you for your service. He's been a security officer in the Middle East. He's been a landscaper. He's been a taxi driver, of course. A pilot, airplane pilot, slumlord. And most recently, he's been a scuba diving instructor, roofer, writer for magazines, a Google AdSense owner, and a COVID survivor. And now he's a father. Without further ado, my good friend, Josh Latuka. That was a nightmare of a list. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks, Vince. That list sounded like a Russian bot wrote it, so appreciate it.
Yeah. I think you're spam on this podcast. You're my spam guest. Hey, COVID. Are you currently going through COVID right now?
No. I've healed. I purged it from my system. I really found the best way to get over it was just to get out there amongst out and about. You know, so when I was in full swing with my symptoms, I started walking around. I did a lot of mall walks. I visited friends, family, people that I hadn't seen in a while. And,
no, I'm just kidding.
Yeah, I had it for about 1 month.
Okay. And how did you deal with it? Like, is it pretty casual or? You're the first person I know, by the way, that had.
Yeah, I'm the first person I know that I had it. So I didn't know I had it for the first couple of weeks, but I just pretended like I did. You know, I stayed in. I was in the process of moving at the time. And so I just kept doing stuff. And after about a week and a half, I had been out my yard cutting down trees. I'd been dragging brush. And then after about a week and a half of having it, I was moving a mattress by myself. And I got to the bottom, it was downstairs, but I got to the bottom of the stairs. And I was like, I feel like I'm going to pass out. And then I just sort of laid down on the mattress outside in my driveway for a little while, and made my way back upstairs, and my pulse was up over like 200. Ooh. And I was like, all right, I better go get a COVID test, because maybe that's what this is. And so I did. I went to one of the drive-through ones and then got it a few days later, and I still had symptoms. So it'd been like 2 weeks of having symptoms, and the first thing they said, they were like, oh yeah, since you had your fever, you know, 2 weeks ago, you're not contagious anymore. And you can go out and mingle with everyone again. And I was like, oh.
That quickly, huh? You're good to go.
That was the day that I found out I had it. And I was like, oh, okay, well, I'm still feeling pretty rough. They're like, yeah, you know, stay in if you want. And they're like, obviously, if you have symptoms longer than a week, go to the emergency room. And I was like, oh, it's been 2 weeks now. And they then I did end up going to the emergency room voluntarily a couple days later, just because my heart rate really wouldn't go down below maybe 100. It usually sits around 50, and just sitting there, it was up at 100, and they didn't have anything to say. They were like, they said maybe just inflammation of the organs.
Just inflammation of the organs.
Yeah.
Yeah, your kidneys.
Heart, lungs,
awesome.
Brain. And
ego.
And then it went away. It went away a couple days later. It went, made its way through my immediate family, and they were both fine. They were had it a lot easier than I did.
Wait, so your little newborn had COVID?
Mm-hmm. I mean, most likely. He experienced maybe a day of light fever, and we're not even really sure of that. The thermometer we had isn't that accurate, so.
Okay.
Yeah, huh. Not much. But then he was good, and that was all. That was like middle of October. It's end of November right now, so.
Interesting.
Yeah. We're in the clear.
So you were basically mocking the fact that you had COVID, like everyone does when they have like the sniffles nowadays, and then turns out you had COVID.
Yeah, I mean, I just out of an abundance of caution, I pretended I had it even while I had it, or even when I just had very minor symptoms, and I didn't want to go out and be spreading it, so I stayed in, and then it turned out to be.
I've been going to the climbing gym once in a while, and mm-hmm. whenever I walk in, of course they ask those common questions of, hey, do you have, you know, any symptoms of COVID? And I'm like, no. And like, have you been in contact with anybody that's had COVID? And I usually say no. But immediately after, I get the insane urge to sneeze because of all the chalk that's like in the gym as you walk in, and your nose, your nostrils not used to it. And I just go like, any signs of COVID? And I'm like, no.
You get to hold that together in public now. It's very, you get to draw a lot of unwanted attention. I was coughing on water the other day, and I ran to the bathroom to do that.
do
that in privacy.
Same thing. I had a spicy like burrito at this little cafe, and it just got in the lungs, and I was like, and I like was looking around. I was like, I swear,
it's mine. It's mine.
It's the Cholula.
Is this your ad? Do you have to advertise for them now?
So this podcast is sponsored by Cholula, green flavor, extra avocado included. So if you want to spice up your meal and your sex life, choose Cholula. Do you have anything to add?
So I actually have a story about Cholula.
Cholula.
Yeah. Now, this was Cholula. I think Cholula bought them out, though.
Okay.
Yeah, so I used to own 6 cats at once.
Dude, my last guests were people that were more or less homeless, I came to realize halfway through the podcast. Now I'm having a dude with 6 cats on the podcast. This thing's going downhill fast.
Yeah.
All right, 6 cat man. Yeah.
Yeah, I had 6 cats, and that's all they would eat was Cholula. So.
Are you serious that you would feed the cat spicy food?
Not food.
Just the sauce.
Yeah.
You would give your cats spicy sauce.
Yeah.
Isn't that poisonous for cats?
Yeah, probably. That's probably what happened.
You don't have 6 cats now, do you?
I don't.
Okay. Well,
I don't have any.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. Moving on from the PETA lawsuit. The reason I wanted to have you on the podcast again is I think you are one of those few individuals, and we haven't gotten that yet from our COVID interaction because it's just so morose, but you are quite the storyteller, and I recall just all the predicaments that you would get into as far as like us in rescue swimmer school together. And one of the things that came to mind was, didn't you wedding crash / sneak into an upper class regatta gala or something at one point during our rescue swimmer trials?
Yeah, it was on a weekend. I mean, it wasn't that hard. Me and Matt, we went out and just rented, or not even rented, we went to the thrift store to grab some tuxedos because we had seen a line of people in tuxedos outside the Wells Fargo Tower in Norfolk. And we're like, that looks cool. And we walked in, and there was just like a paper sign that said the Vermouth Tasting Room. And I didn't know what vermouth was, but it sounded cool. And so we didn't get any vermouth. That was my one complaint with the event. And I really shouldn't complain because I think we were supposed to have tickets. But because nobody asked, because we were wearing the tuxedos, so they assumed we were supposed to be there. And they just there was an elevator there full of people. And they were like, oh, are you going up? We said, yeah. And so I think it ended up being an auction for doctors. They were auctioning off art for a hospital, and so most of the people there maybe were owners of the hospital or doctors or whatever. I do know that we were discovered. Yeah.
Did they kick you out? That's the end of your story? Come on!
No, they didn't kick us out. We had made friends with the staff pretty good at that point. Matt had been pulling them out onto the dance floor. Anyways, we were pretty beloved at that moment, so...
So more or less Wedding Crashers movie, except you guys finagled it. I mean, I feel like they finagled it so well in those movies too. Even if they did find out, I feel like those were acceptable Wedding Crashers. They just ramped up the party. Their entertainment.
Exactly. They, yeah. We were a gift.
You. Yeah, I mean, any white collar party needs a blue collar shit show to put some entertainment into the.
That's exactly it. Yeah, and that was the junior enlisted members from the Coast military. Guard. Yeah, that was us. Yeah. Enjoying the finer things. Actually, one fun thing from that, it's like, it's probably an old joke that I didn't know, but I was there looking at the menu, and I unironically, just genuinely in good faith, asked the person in front of me, like, what are these hors d'oeuvres? And it's hors d'oeuvres is the word, spelled H-O-R-S. And they didn't laugh. They just rolled right on to, like, oh, no, sir, that's hors d'oeuvres. Yeah, so that was when I learned that word. Or how to spell it.
Hey, before we get into your shenanigans out at sea, you're a scuba diver now? When did this happen? Scuba diving instructor. Any scuba diving predicaments?
No, not predicaments, but it was not at all what I expected. So scuba diving, are you a scuba diver? Have you done PADI courses?
Yeah, dude. I'm advanced PADI scuba diver. That's sure. A pretty big deal. I can go down to what, like 120 feet? Is that what it is?
Something like 130. So
there you go.
What I was gonna say is, like, they're designed for small children, you know, and so as you know.
Wait, what's designed for small children?
PADI is designed for, like, children and up, right? So it's like you can be a scuba diver as not small, but you can be a scuba diver at 11 years old, or you can be, you know, so so it's not. So I was picturing, like, wow, scuba diving. This will be super intense. And then I showed up. And, like, we're watching these info videos where they're like, can you put your face in the water? And I'm like, oh, man, what did I sign up for? So then we go, you have to do these open water dives to do your initial certification, which are meant to be very easy. Well, the place we were at is called Radio Island, and the current rips through this place. It's riddled with sea urchins everywhere. The visibility was maybe 6 inches. There's just dark, shadowy figures all around you in the water that you don't know what they are. And, man, it sucked. So that was my very first, like, open water dive. And the next, when we did our advanced that you were talking about, they took us out to a wreck offshore. And the boat captain there, he's like your typical, what you would expect a dive boat captain to be. You know, he was probably an alcoholic at one point. He's recovered now. He kind of talks in a nasally voice. He doesn't really, like, ever look you in the eyes because he's busy doing stuff. And so as I was going off the edge of the boat, he's like, watch out for the sharks down there. Yeah, whatever. And I go down, and I wasn't paying attention to where I was going at all because it was my first time doing a deep dive, so I'm looking at the gauges in each hand, just slowly sinking down. And by the time I looked up, everyone was pointing at a shark swimming by, and it was, like, pretty big, maybe 6 feet. And I was like, it's really cool. I think tiger sharks are the ones with the snaggly teeth. I think I'm right about that. But they're intense looking, whatever they are, and I didn't know what they were. And I was like, wow, that's pretty cool. Like, that's a big shark. I hope it's okay for us to be here. And then I noticed, like, everyone's looking in my direction now. So I just, like, hey, what's up, guys? I'm here. And then I kind of feel my fin tip graze something, and I look down, and there's a shark, like, maybe this big around, swimming beneath me that I've just hit with my fin. And I kind of start recognizing everything around me, and there's maybe 40 of them just all around, and I'm kind of in the middle of this whirlwind of sharks. And again, I mean, that's what people go to that wreck for, but I didn't know that, and you can't talk underwater. So in my mind, I'm like, I've made a deadly mistake. I've done everything you're not supposed to. I wasn't paying attention to my surroundings, and now I'm in a shark vortex. And so I'm like, I think that I'm being super stealthy, just kind of gliding away from these sharks, thinking, like, in my mind, my heart rate's at 1,000, and I'm, like, in a survival situation. And to everyone else, yeah, it's just like, it just looks like I'm lazily swimming around these sharks like I'm supposed to be, because that's what people go to the wreck for. And again, there's, like, you know, there's elderly people there are kids doing it, but I didn't know. I thought I was about to die. And then, though, the next time we did, so like I said, that school was about 11 months, so that was in the summer. Well, we were still diving in the winter, and we ended up going to that same wreck, and it's called the Aeolus, and it's known for its sharks. Again, that's why people go there. So when we went back, I think it was November, there was no visibility. It was dark, cloudy water. It was overcast skies. It was just dark in general. It was close to sunset. The water was cold, and we just had to do some dives for numbers. I forget why, for some qualification we were doing, and get out. And talk about horrible. Just being in this dark pit, knowing there's like a shipwreck around you and knowing you're surrounded by all the sharks. They're still there, you just can't see them. And then we had to swim around the wreck for whatever reason, doing something, maybe navigating. And like every now and then you just see one right in front of you because you've swam up to them, and they don't move, they don't care that you swim up to them. It was awful. There were a lot of dive stories like that, so there was nothing ever hairy. I did see a buddy, he had a crazy one. He the guy I was diving with, he got distracted, and you know, if you float up when you're diving and you go up too fast, then the nitrogen bubbles in your blood can expand and cause the bends, and so you have to ascend at a certain rate. And he knew that. He had been in the same class I was, so we'd both been doing it for a while. But I forget what, he was just looking at something, and he had added a little bit of air, and he just started ascending faster and faster and faster. We were at 100 feet down. It just so happened that another guy was coming down as he was going up and like grabbed him and took his arrow, but probably another couple seconds and he would have been to the point where he wouldn't have been able to control. He'd already gone up way further than he should have at that rate. So it was probably really close to getting the bends. And at that, like I said, at that depth, the bends would be a pretty big deal. He was fine. He said he felt weird afterwards, but he didn't seek medical attention.
People that get the bends, apparently it's not necessarily just getting the bends, but also flying shortly after diving is a big danger. And I've had some friends that have made the mistake of doing that. You know, you travel in, say, Southeast Asia, and you forget about it or something, and you have a flight the next day or something. They say it's the worst pain like ever in their life. It's like their blood vessels are coming through their pores like everywhere, and it's just aching pain in every single joint. And I totally get, like, as far as what your buddy, the mistake he did, right? Like, if you have that air within your vest as you're ascending, well, you know, as you get higher, that air expands, right? Because like with under the water pressure, it's compressed. So the more he's ascending, the more he's like, that air is coming back into his vest, and thus like throwing him up further. And if you're distracted, then yeah, you're shooting up like a rocket, and you know, exponentially. So yeah, you definitely got to be on your purge valve to get back like lower. And that's, yeah, it's pretty funny because that is a risky situation that can happen to anyone if you get distracted.
It's an easy one too. Like, I mean, it happened in a few seconds, and we were just like, oh, there goes Benny.
There goes Benny. they call him bubbly skin Ben. What about flight? You know, you're also a pilot. Before we get into your story, any flight issues?
No, I mean, you've been in helicopters, I know, so you know everything's with a checklist. So yeah. There's nothing really cowboy happening with the flight. The funniest part of my flight experience was my first lesson. The guy who took me out, he had been an Air Force pilot. It was like a Vietnam War vet, and I think I was his last student, and he was like, all right, let's make this an experience. And so the very first flight we went out on, he was like, I want you to do anything you can think of with the aircraft. It was a Cessna, which are very stable airplanes. He goes, I want you to do anything you can think of. It doesn't matter. I'll show you what's recoverable. And so I just trusted this guy implicitly, and I was sitting there doing everything I could think of. And I learned later I was stalling it sideways. I was putting a lot of pressure on the wings, and he just let me do it. And then he was like, see, we're fine. And then later as I was learning, I was like, oh no, you can't just do that. Like, yeah, you're fine, but you're not supposed to do a full throttle while turning down in a Cessna, whatever, you know. You're not supposed to put those amount of G's on the structure, even though technically it can do it. it can also lead to a problem. So that was it. That was just, and I learned all that pretty quick. So from then on, I was always kind of afraid at anything he said. So he'd be like, it'd be maybe a normal drill to turn the fuel off while you're flying to practice landing without power. But when he would do it, I'd be wondering, like, is it going to start again? Is this just something he does? But that was it. It always went well. He knew what he was doing.
Do you ever think he was like a suicidal vet?
Yeah, like, you know, just a little bit. Like, not suicidal, but I think it was, you know, he was getting older and he was like, he wanted to enjoy it, get a little bit riskier with it. So the plane that I soloed in, you do your first solo while you're still a student, the plane that I soloed in crashed into a mountain 2 months later. I don't know what happened, but a friend of mine on Instagram sent a picture of like, hey, check out this plane wreck I found in Washington. And I was looking at it and I was like, oh, yeah. And I saw the tail number and it was the plane that I learned to fly in.
What's that story all about? We need them on the podcast.
Yeah.
Are they dead? Is there no podcast to be had?
No, I know everyone survived.
Oh.
Yeah. I'll reach out. I'll see what happened.
That'd be good.
Maybe it was cool. Maybe they were just drunk.
Plane crash number two to come on the Wildertainment podcast. Subscribe, leave a rating, review, and all that. Blah, blah, blah. Okay, moving on.
And buy Cholula
by the gallon. Yeah. And use promo code Wildertainment. Thank you very much. I'm going to be rich on this podcast. God damn, I love podcasting. All right, Joshua. Should we talk about this boat race?
Yeah. Yeah, what do you want to know?
Tell me your survival story.
Well, it's called the Race to Alaska. It was 2015, and it was the first year they were doing it.
Is it the last year they were doing it?
No, but they did enforce some restrictions for who could enter after that year.
Okay.
And we don't know for sure why, but I think I could take a guess. Well, I saw some ad online for the Race to Alaska, and it was advertising it. It's like the Iditarod on the water, right? It sounded cool. It was an epic race. And so it was going to be 750 miles in a self-propelled or wind-driven, just not mechanized watercraft from Port Townsend, Washington to Kodiak, Alaska, which follows the Inside Passage, which is a pretty cool set of waterways inside some Canadian border islands.
So wait, where does this race start and end over these 750 miles?
Port Townsend, Washington and Kodiak, Alaska.
Oh my God, you have to make it through the Bering Sea? Like through the Aleutian Chains?
Wait, Kodiak?
No. Kodiak's an island, right?
Ketchikan, Alaska.
Okay. So that's on the mainland? Yeah.
You still have to make it through some rough waters, but yeah.
It's still the Bering Sea.
Right.
Have you been in the Bering Sea, dude?
No, I haven't.
Okay, that's probably why you entered this race.
Yeah. So, well, let's get into why I entered the race, actually, shall we? So I saw the ad, and you know what the first thing I did when I saw the ad? And
what?
I saw how you entered a team and everything else. I texted out some friends.
Okay.
You want to know who was in that group of friends, Vince?
No.
It was you. You were one of them. You and four other people agreed to do it with me. Agreed to do the race with me.
It was on to contingency, my friend. It was on contingency.
Yeah, it was pretty clear. Like, yeah, I said the dates. I was like, hey, I'm going to go ahead and sign up. It's a $600 sign-up fee. And everyone was like, yeah, let's do it, man. I'm excited. I was like, cool. And so I did. I signed up. And then, well, I know you didn't do it. And I know no one else did. One by one, everybody backed out. And
wait,
so,
who was the last to back out?
I think it was you.
I think it was me. Yeah.
Yeah, you were.
I think I was contingent. I said, like, I don't have the time right now to build up a boat, but I will invest if you need funds and everyone else is, like, involved. But, you know, it was one
That's
of those
right.
group projects.
And so we had all kind of agreed on, like, $3,000 each for a boat, which with six people would have been $18,000, so we could have gotten...
Is that what we said? I never said I would give you $3,000, my friend. I was broke.
that was the amount. It was $3,000, which would have been $18,000 towards, like, some sort of a racing yacht. And what
can you buy a decent yacht for $18,000?
You can get a better boat than you can for $3,000, which is what I had to do. So, because everyone else backed out. And I kind of drew a line in the sand and said I wasn't going to back out and I was going to do it even if I had to go alone.
I recall you being very determined about like this race. You're like, listen, I am doing this race and yeah. I want all of us to do it. And to be fair, who you recruited would have been a very entertaining group dynamic.
Yeah, not just that. It would have been a capable crew. It was I never thought that it would be smart to try to navigate the inside passage alone for the first time doing any kind of sailing whatsoever. So I like chose people with outdoor accolades. And
why don't you describe who you wanted your crew to be and why you chose them?
Well, I had you in the rescue swimmer school. You'd been very good in the water. You were a rescue swimmer at the time. I chose people in the Coast Guard because I knew that everyone had an income and they would come through on their $3,000. I chose Ryan Fogeth because he's from Michigan. You know, he's another experienced outdoorsman. He spends a lot of time beaver trapping. He really is legitimately very capable at like northern country camping. That's what he grew up doing, and that was we were going to have to do a lot of that along the route. We were going to have to pull in, instead of sleeping on the boat, we had kind of all agreed, yeah, we should pull in every night, even though we knew the winner most likely was going to have to sleep on their boat. And they did. The winner ended up doing it in like 4 days, right? My best plan, when it was my plan just for me, like best case scenario was 3 weeks for me. And even that, it was like, who knows? Yeah, so Ryan Fogeth.
We're going to have Ryan on the podcast coming up talking about a very long distance canoe race in
oh, that's right. Northern Michigan. I forgot. That was part of it. He had done long distance boat races before. So that was definitely part of it.
On a canoe. like through rivers. Like, okay, continue. Sorry. Who else was on the crew?
So my buddy Jason.
Yeah.
I worked with him at the time. He's a surfman in the Coast Guard, which means that he takes boats into surf, high surf, and a very experienced waterman, very, very capable at navigation, like operations planning type thing, because that's what he did in the Coast Guard. I don't remember. Do you know who else I had on there?
Eric.
I think, and Lamy. Oh,
yeah. Whatever. Yeah.
That was his nickname.
Yeah,
he was lame. I don't know that I had him. I don't know that he committed, yeah. But I think I had another guy I worked with, Quade. He would have been great. He might have been the last one to back out, and I think it might have been because our station wouldn't let us both go at the same time. We worked at the same place, doing the same job. But he would have been. I mean, he was out every minute, every waking minute. He was out in the outdoors. He lived in a van while we were at station. He just transformed a Sprinter van into a Sprinter van with a bed in it, basically, and lived in that.
That's probably before van life was actually a popular thing.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. He was one of the forerunners, and now it's cool. He's taking military trucks and turning them into houses. So
whoa, what's a military truck?
I don't know, like it'd be like a diesel box truck, that surplus military diesel box trucks. So I don't know which one specifically.
Like those old ones that like would carry the troops in World War II?
No, they're newer than that.
Okay, gotcha.
They get like 7 miles to the gallon. But I can't remember who else. So Quade's, Jason, you, me, Ryan, and I guess it must have been Eric. One by one over the. It wasn't like one by one. Everyone backed out that day or even that week. It was over the next 6 months because I had signed up for it in November and the race was going to be in June. And so even earlier than that, it was almost a year of preparation that I had. So it was November that I ended up buying the boat because I realized, oh, everyone's backed out and I need to train. Like I need to learn how to sail first of all. So there was a guy at my work that built boats. And he had two, actually. One, he was like, oh, this is definitely what you need to get to Alaska. And it was, maybe 18 feet, double-ended. It was nicer. And I couldn't afford that one. So I got the other one, which was 15 feet, you could row it in a single sail. It was
a canoe?
No, not quite a canoe. It was completely open, though, to the elements, obviously. So it wasn't self-bailing. Yeah.
Sure.
And I had never sailed before. Yeah. No, I came up with, though, one cool thing about this story. A little bit of spoiler alert to this story before, so it doesn't just end. I don't make it to Alaska, believe it or not. Yeah. But it was cool. And, man, I came up with some innovative systems that I was proud of. So, first of all, I'd never sailed before, and I needed to learn how to sail. So I got this boat. It was now winter in Washington State. And so the very first day, I took it out on a lake with that guy Quaid, which is probably why he ended up backing out. And so I had, like, read a book and maybe watched some YouTube videos, and I was like, oh, okay, I get it. And so we get in the lake, and when we first get in the lake, we're not going anywhere. I've got the sail up. It's a big lake. And I've got the sail up, and I can kind of see the wind on the water. It didn't look crazy to me at all. And I was like, oh, once we hit that, it should be fine. So we're just sitting there talking. Neither of us have life jackets, dry suits, wetsuits, anything on. And we're just drifting towards these little ripples. And this is the first time I've ever been in the boat. And the wind, as soon as we hit those ripples, the wind catches the sail. It smashes around on this wooden boom, almost tips the boat over. We take a bunch of water in right then and there. I yank on the rope that brings it around in, you know, a reflex move, the wrong reflex to have, because then it yanks it to the middle, immediately whips it to the other direction. And over the next 40 minutes, we're just ripping across this lake, like sideways and diagonal. No control. It's a push stick tiller that's like I'm not used to yet, so we keep spinning in circles, and then the boom would whip to the other side, and I hadn't learned you have to keep some tension to prevent that.
So, like, this is why this podcast is fun, because we have like so many diversified fields of outdoorsiness. What's a push stick tiller?
I'm not sure it's called that. So most of what you'll hear from me on the boating stuff, I probably made up, because I just this was my first, but I think that might be right. So it's a stick attached to a tiller. Instead of sitting there and you know, turning it with your hand like you would a boat outboard or with a helm, you pull the stick, and it's like on a little thing that pivots. So you pull it and it pulls out, and it will turn the rudder one way, and if you push it back, then it will turn the rudder the other way, and that's how you steer the boat. And the rudder is just a piece of wood about this big on the end.
It's a flat piece of wood.
Yeah, it's a shaped the way it's supposed to, but yeah. Exactly. And so that was the very first experience in the boat, and it was a little sobering. And so I started thinking, like, wow, I'm really, like, the race is in, you know, 6 months at that point, so I really got to start getting my shit together. Well, I started going out just on my own. Sometimes I would bring friends, and they'd to give them the experience, but I just started going out on my own in this thing and learned how to sail and did it pretty successfully. I got to the point that I could sail it, and I started piecing the things together, though. This was where it got cool. This was the part I liked. I spent a lot of money, but I just started buying gear. I went through and I researched all this gear. I had no approval from my work to do this at this point, and everyone, including the people who were going to give me my approval, told me, you will not get approved to do this. This is insane. And I was like, yeah, it's fine.
So just for folks listening in, yeah, you were in the Coast Guard. You were basically a rescue boat driver. And for folks that weren't in the military, yeah, you need to get approval from your command, from the officers. I guess, but like, what kind of approval chit would you need for that?
So, first of all, just to take leave in general, you have to say why. And it was a small station, so they knew why. And you can't do whatever you want, right? They have to approve it. And so one of the things they have to approve is that it's safe for you, because if they approve you to go somewhere that's unsafe, it can come back negatively on them. So they take it seriously. The other thing I needed to do was, because the race went through Canada, I had to do a foreign leave packet, which is another pain.
You know, that's a nightmare.
It's the same foreign leave packet if you go to Canada as it is if you go to Iran. So it's like, it was difficult.
There's some dangerous Canadians up there, though.
Yeah, for sure. I met them.
They'll stab you with a broken maple leaf bottle.
So I started piecing gear together.
What's your first buy?
Oh, I don't remember everything. I bought everything. I bought everything I needed that I could afford.
Did you have like a dry suit kind of thing?
Yeah, so somebody had given me a dry suit. I had two dry suits. One might have been sourced from work.
You had a Coast Guard dry suit doing this? This is so counterintuitive to the service.
It didn't say Coast Guard. I think it was just an old orange one from back when Hurricane Sandy hit.
Okay.
We had to throw away a lot of them.
Yeah, yeah. A little duct tape.
Yeah. Yeah, I had a dry suit. I had this vest, so I created this vest that it had all my safety stuff in it, just like you do when you're on the boat or the helicopter. Those vests, you've got your flares and whistle, mirror. I had some emergency. I had like some stuff in case I actually ended up in the water to maybe help survive a little bit. Some heat packs, like not that was would have done much, but some drinking water, a couple of packets of drinking water. And then I had that attached to this kind of like bungee safety cord that I had made that was pretty good, and that was tied to all these different dry bags that all floated, and also a set of fins.
Of course you brought fins.
Yeah, well, because I was going to be getting in and out of the boat every day, so like sometimes it might be easier if there's a little bit of surf to just swim in and then drag the boat in or something.
Oh, that's true. Oh my god, yeah. Dude, that's such a helicopter rescue swimmer like mindset of, you know, I'll use my physical if push comes to shove in this situation.
Well, and the idea with the fins too was, so it was all tied to the stuff. So if I went in the water, and that was tied to the boat. Also, I had the tiller on a bungee cord. This part I thought of too. All of this was like kind of innovation, so that if I fell out of the boat, it wouldn't just keep going and then drag me. It would go hard to one side and circle around, which it would have like circled around to probably run me over, but still it was small enough.
Yeah, but that's smart. At least you could have caught it.
Right? Yeah. I was pretty proud of that one.
That is smart.
Yeah. Well, I really thought this might kill me, so I really was trying to think of ways of winning. Because I just started watching videos, more and more videos of the inside passage, and it gets rough.
What's the inside passage?
That's the route you take to Alaska on the inside of the, like, inside of Vancouver Island.
Yeah. So you go, like, through, like, by Squamish and stuff, and, like, you're not, like, out on the sea, per se. You're
it's the inside passage.
Oh,
so,
that's beautiful. Yeah. Right, that's, it like, is. That's nearby here. Yeah.
But you do cross some pretty big openings between those islands and Alaska. There are some bigger gaps there. I think the biggest crossing is 40 miles. One of the biggest is 40 miles, and that's the first day. I hope I'm right about that. Either way, it was pretty big.
Yeah.
So I had that set up. I had these food bags that I made, because my plan was to camp every single night. So I had really good camping gear. I had everything in dry bags, like I said. So if I did go in the water and somehow the boat did get away from me, or the boat sank or was totally totaled, then I would have at least these like supplies. And the idea was I should be, for the most part, within sight of land, so I could swim to land. That's why I had the fins and with all my stuff.
So your emergency plan is to swim with all your gear that's floating to land. Yeah. So you secure your assets and your life.
Yeah. Yeah, I didn't want to lose my stuff. Well, and the more practical reason to that was because even though land is there, a lot of it was super remote land, and my assets included a PLB that was in the vest, though, a satellite phone that was in a Pelican case, and then all the stuff to survive. So if legitimately it was a reasonable concern that the boat was going to sink, which happened to a lot of people.
On this race, a lot of boats sunk?
Yeah, there were actually some Coast Guard rescues.
Because of this race?
Yeah. Yeah.
Whoa.
Yeah. So, oh yeah, and so like to swim to land, I would also have all the stuff to warm up after getting out of the water, right? So like your tent and your sleeping bag and all that was in dry bags.
Yeah.
So it was smart. So I also made these food bags, and it was pretty cool. Dry sealed bags, vacuum sealed bags that I made. And I filled them up with a bunch of grains and cereal, and then I self-dried a ton of fruit and vegetables, which I would never do again. For the amount of vegetables that I bought and the amount of time it took to dehydrate these things, you could just buy them basically the same price. They get so small, you can just buy them pre-dried. But anyways, I made all my own, put them all into these bags, put a couple of cups of instant coffee, a bunch of chocolates in them for like quick sugar, and like Gatorade packets. And each one of those was a full day's meal. So the idea was I could just sit there and feed all day while I was going up the inside passage. And then I had also some of your normal Mountain House meals that you just add hot water to.
Yeah. Those are expensive enough
as it is. And they took up a lot of room was the problem. So
yeah, but they're light.
Yeah, they're light, but they were in a boat. I didn't care about carrying them. I just needed them to not take up too much space.
I don't know. So isn't weight an issue in such a small vessel? A little bit?
It was probably the least of my issues. I definitely wasn't concerned. Actually, I added a lot of weight to keep, you know, to even out the keel. So I got these two big things of fresh water that I filled up, like maybe 5-gallon jugs. I don't know what they were. Like the army cans. You've seen them. And I filled those with fresh water. And then the plan was to restock. So I also came up with all these GPS waypoints of where I was going to camp each night. And really had it all planned out and included places of sources near fresh water. But also you can pull in and buy things too, right? So for the first week you're along Vancouver Island, you can just pull in to a hose at the marina and refill. Some guys ended up, they would call ahead and order pizzas, and then they would have the person meet them out at the marina and they would just grab it as their boat was going by and then head out. Like,
that's sick.
On the race, yeah. So I was the only solo entry, I think. At least at that point, I was.
Is there no I guess not qualification phase, but like where they check your qualifications and your boat and your vessel?
Not then. Now there is. So, but it was the first year they were doing it, and they were excited. They were as excited as I was. The people putting it on, and they were like, "Wow, that's so cool, man! You really think you're gonna make it?" And I was like, "Yeah." Planning on it. Yeah. So the day,
I just saw the PTSD in your face. Yeah.
The day of the race. Oh, when I got it real quick, when I got it approved, right? Mm-hmm. So my command was like, "Hey, bring your boat in so we can inspect it." Because I don't know if they have to, but they gave me the benefit of the doubt to be like, "Sure, we'll hear your case," right? So they're like, Bring in your boat. And so my buddy Quaid, that had the Sprinter van, towed it in, so it looked horrible. Like, the Sprinter van's massive. It was the worst thing to tow it with. It just looked tiny, and it was. It was this small boat. The sail was down, just in the boat. That's how he stored it. And so they were all out there, the three members of command were all out there staring at it, just like, "All right, this is it, huh?" I was like, yep. And then I'm thinking I'm smooth, right? And I was like, "Yeah, you know, and I've got a bungee cord. That way, if I fall out, it just circles around me." And they're like, "It's just a bungee cord wrapped around this piece of wood." And they're like, "All right."
So you're trying to keep a straight face in front of these.
Oh, like, I was dead serious.
Are they officers or chiefs or what? Who's looking at your boat?
A senior chief and two chiefs. And luckily, two of the chiefs were on their way out. One was retiring and one was heading to Hawaii, which I think is how it got approved. But so the other thing, it came down to this one chief who was staying there, and the theory later on was that he was just trying to kill me. But at the time, we didn't know why, but I provided him this binder where I had printed out every single item I'd bought. I had itinerized every GPS waypoint. I had put in everything I could think of to be like, "Hey, this is how I've mitigated the risk," right? And including, like I said, the satellite phone, EPIRB or a PLB, everything. Everything. I've just been telling you.
Yeah.
And I turned it into him, and then like 2 weeks later, somehow he handed it back to me, and they had approved it. And like nothing, no other comments. I was like, "All right." And I guess his comment was like, later on, was like, "Yeah, you know, if you put in that work, whatever." So the day of the race, I show up with a couple of friends, some of their wives, and we had gotten to Port Townsend a couple days early to stay there to get ready for the launch. And so they had this big party beforehand, not my friends, but the actual people putting on the race, to show off all the boats and all the teams. And so it's all these legit catamarans and trimarans and like 80-foot boats and just their sponsored matching teams, and people are there comparing things that I don't even, like, comparing, you know, gadgets they've got that I have no idea, and I'm just, and then I'm there with my two-piece dry suit, like, wrapping bungee cords around things and tying off stuff, and I was nervous. I was shaky, pale. I'd been drinking Monster Energy drinks for, like, 2 days straight for whatever reason. Whew. I remember, like, my friends, too, they weren't laughing. They weren't, it wasn't, like, fun. They were just, they were like, are you sure? You don't have to do this. Like, you really don't have to go. I was like, no, it's fine. It's fine. So the morning of the race, it was 5 a.m. It was cool. So I show up. I was still kind of nervous, but it was like, whatever. So the first leg was just over to Canada. You cross the Strait of Juan de Fuca, and then you rest there for a couple days before doing the rest of it. And so it was like, oh, whatever, you know, it's day one. I'll do day one. And I show up, it's 5 in the morning. Tons of people are out to watch this thing. There are people on paddle boards handing out oatmeal to the boats that are already set up, because some boats are, like, trying to win, right? And they're on the race line, and I'm just on the beach, like, I'll launch and not be in their way, basically. There's a full moon, it's all snow-capped mountains around there, the sunrise, and they announce over the some giant PA system, like, the race is about to begin, and then they set off all these bells, and we're like, I gotta go, and so my friends shove out my boat, and they're all sitting there yelling. They had spray-painted Virginia on it the day before, so, like, just to add to the scene, instead of it being, like, all these boats are professional-looking, and mine just has Virginia spray-painted on it, kind of haphazardly. Like, they ran out of room at the end, so the last three letters were smaller. And they're yelling, Virginia! Which I guess was the name of the boat, in hindsight. And, man, the people putting on the race were blaring out this, like, opera gladiator music while my friends are shouting, and it's the moon and the sun, and there's drones coming down filming, and I was just there like, this is my destiny, this is my, you know, like, this is amazing. And then this is on footage, actually. Their official footage is pretty good. You can kind of see my boat. And I'm in that moment, I remember being like, wow, this is incredible. And, like, right then, this giant catamaran just goes by me at, you know, 6 times the speed that I am, wakes me out, and I'm in there bobbing. I'm like, oh, shit, this is going to be rough. And so the very first thing that happened was I had a radio, right? And so I head out, and the very first thing that happened, people were panicking. So there were a bunch of teams that were just doing the short section over to Canada, which would have been smart for me to do. And a lot of them had boats like I did. And so we got out of the harbor, and it was a little bit choppy, but nothing. I mean, nothing any boat can't handle, nothing a canoe can't handle, anything. And people were over the radio like, I need you to come get me right now. This is ridiculous to start the race right now. And so one of the guys put in his GPS coordinates, and I was like, maybe he's actually in trouble. He had put it out over the radio, so I just plugged it in. I had a little handheld GPS, and I went over there, and he was okay. I mean, he had stopped any forward momentum, so the chop was real bad on him. And I was like, hey, man, he had a better boat than I did for sure. And I was like, hey, man, are you good? And he was like, I need to get back in there. And I was like, all right, well, I'm going to keep going with the race. Like, do you need anything? He was like, no. Don't leave. I might need to come over there. For whatever reason, he had just thought maybe my boat was better. So I hung out with him for like 20 minutes until their response boat. They had some helpers out, some volunteers and response boats out for that first day. And they came over and got him. So that was like the first 20 minutes of my race was just sitting there. And that boosted my confidence a lot, because I was like, I guess if this is what people are talking about, it being bad, like, whatever, this is nothing.
I'm picturing, like, the opening scene to the movie Troy with Brad Pitt with all these, like, war vessels ready to go, and they blast off. And in the back of the Troy, like, scene with all the vessels, there's, like, a tiny skiff with you. Yes. In the back.
Yeah, exactly. Dressed to the nines.
Just, like, ready for war as well. You probably showed up after the whole Troy battle. Like, it's over?
So then I continue on. And you're supposed to cut across the shipping lanes at a 90-degree angle, And I was like, I just gotta get there. So I was just beelining for it. And the currents basically made it so that I made them at a 90 degree angle, which I kind of did intentionally. But either way, I had my boat pointed directly at Victoria, or where I knew it was. And man, it got rough. It was choppy. So there's upwelling there, which is where the water boils from the bottom. So it's like sailing in a giant pot of boiling water. And it would be every little short section. So I'd go through like 20 minutes of smooth water where I was like, man, this is amazing. This is awesome. This is the life. I'm eating my granola packets that I've made. And then all of a sudden, it would just sound, the way I described it was, it sounded like a bunch of piranha would all of a sudden be eating the water. Like it just got like real choppy and just like, ch-ch-ch-ch-ch. And then I knew it was going to happen. And then everything would be bouncing all over the place, and I'd be sitting there with the tiller, and I'd have to hunker into the bottom, and water would be coming in. I had some foot pump, I think, to pump water out. I might have had an electric bilge set up, a battery powered or solar powered actually, but it wasn't working real well, so I had to do the foot pump thing. Yeah, so that went on for about 9 hours, just doing that for 9 hours, 20 minutes smooth, 20 minutes rough, thinking like, oh man, I'm gonna sink. I saw, it got so crazy looking out there. There was fog walls that were just hard 90 degree lines, and I couldn't tell what I was looking at. I was kind of near the San Juan Islands, but they looked crazy far away on each side. I think it might have just been a little bit of illusion, but I've been through there on powered boats, and it's just the same. It's very strange waters. That upwelling kind of just creates a lot of weird currents. And then I saw one cool thing. So I was sitting there and I just happened to like look out into the water, and I was staring at this one spot. I don't know if, why, but then this giant gray whale or humpback whale, it was one of the really big ones, comes completely out of the water so high that I can see like the horizon mountains underneath it, and then just goes into the water pretty close to me, like within 40 yards. So it wakes my boat, and then it was gone, and I didn't see it again. But it was just, what are the odds of that, you know? So then I was out there.
Does it make you feel small?
Yes, that was the best way to describe it. And then I'll wrap up a little bit. So I ended up going for 9 hours or so, and then I saw I was doing really well. My friends were tracking me with a GPS tracker that the people made me put on my boat. And so you can track all the boats, and just the angle that I had taken and the way the currents were, I had beat out a lot of the bigger boats. Yeah, I was doing pretty good, you know, and a bunch had quit already.
How many people in this race? Like how many boats?
40 or 50 or so.
How many quit at this point?
I think like 15 or 20 quit that first day. So there might have been like 60 boats. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So I saw all my competition kind of up north of me. And this is where, this was the dumbest thing I did, but it was kind of a forgivable dumb mistake. You know, if I had sailed those waters before, I would have understood just how much the currents sweep north through the inside passage, but I didn't. And so I turned in to those guys. Just, I was like, if that's where the boats are, I'll just join them, and then I'll be around boats that are in the race, and I'll finish up. I was in the last hour of it, I thought. And I was like, and I'll join them. And it'll be nice. Well, so I kind of turned them. What I needed to do, as it turned out, was turn my boat the exact opposite direction and get out of that opening where the current rips through. But instead, I started turning with the current and immediately was swept up north of those boats because they were fighting with all their might to get across and get out. And I just didn't know that. You know, you can't tell when they're a mile away. And so I understood pretty quickly, like, I need to get out of this. Tried going straight across. Well, it's a major shipping lane for container ships, and there was one coming down where I was crossing, and I was going to be crossing in front of it. So anyways, I turned in towards these boats, and the current had me pretty good, and I didn't realize how bad it was yet. But so I turned against it, and I had a single sail, small double-ended boat. The single sail with the wind I had was not enough to go directly against it. So I was attempting to just cross this section of water, maybe a half a mile wide, maybe even 3/4 of a mile, not long. That's all I had to cross. Well, the shipping channel went right through it, And so after I tried going directly against the current and failing, I needed to go across it. And this container ship was coming down. Biggest container ship I've ever seen, literally. Just, I haven't seen one like it. It was stacked ridiculously high with these trees, and it was cutting across. And I...
With these trees?
Yeah, it was stacked, I guess, for logging, but they had roots still. So I don't know what the deal was. It looked crazy. Like I said, I've never seen anything like it since. It was
That's the Canada stacked. Logging for you, yeah.
Yeah, I guess. They just take them out by the roots. And so I was going this way, and it's coming this way, and it's a long ways off. But I'm slow, and they're faster than they look, and I know that. And so I'm going, and then finally, I'm like, fuck it. So I try to turn up against it again, and that doesn't work, and I'm drifting down, and this thing goes by, and it's waking me out really bad. So now it's been a couple of hours stuck in this one current.
So the thing goes by? It was fine? Yeah. So you got run out over by a cargo ship.
Well, I had turned away to avoid that. So it was still a few hundred yards away. They make a lot of wake, you know? And also the sun is starting to set now, and the currents are bad. The water's real choppy. I'm out in this area. The current is stronger than my sail. It's getting worse, right? So I make the decision to try to row against the current instead of sail. And so I took down the sail, which wasn't really something I had planned to do in the water unless I needed to, because it's hard. You have to go and lift this giant piece of wood out, set it down. It's unstable. But I did it, and I started rowing. And I rowed.
Wait, so you're rowing out at sea, like in this, 15-foot boat?
Yeah, against the current, against pretty strong tidal current.
I remember when
you
tried to sell me on this adventure, you were like, no, it's going to be great. I'm thinking like a Viking type boat. Like, I'm thinking there should be a dragon on the front. Well, sure, it's going to be a sail, but we can also row a good portion of it.
Which is true.
And I was like, doesn't this thing leave from Washington? And you're like, yeah. And I was like, doesn't it go to Alaska? And you're like, yeah. And I was like, you want me to row that?
So with six people... That would have been reasonable. The plan would have been to row the dead sections. When you had wind, you could have used the sail and then row the other sections, which kind of worked for me. The difference being it was one person in a boat not really suited for these conditions, but six people in a boat suited for it. People did it. They did it successfully.
Like, your idea of this was like running, like being the Viking in charge of a slave ship and just being like, row! And you have the drum in the front.
Absolutely. My vision of what it was going to be more fun than... Yeah, I wasn't looking for a soul-searching, a soul-ringing moment of, like, the balance of life and death where it was my own strengths and weaknesses laid bare. That wasn't what I was after. I was like, it'll be June, we can... It'll be nice. It'll be a couple weeks. There'll be a bunch of us. We'll be camping. It would have been cool, right? Instead...
Just a couple week getaway.
Yeah.
Instead of... Yeah, it's turned into a novel. A dark novel. A Stephen King book.
So, actually, along with that, while I'm rowing at one point, real quick, I'm rowing and I hear this god-awful noise, like... Wah! And I look in the water and I just see this big chunk of, like, flesh in the water. Like, fish, you know? And then I look, and there's a sea lion there, and it's staring at me, and its eyes all red. And I was like, this is kind of cool. Like, I'm not alone now, am I? I've got this sea lion. It must be a totem. And then it makes that noise again, like, wah! And it turns, and it's got half an eye missing, like, dripping out of its skull, just like, wah! It's all red around its mouth, and it was around my boat for the next 5 or 10 minutes. Terrifying. It was as big as the boat, you know. It seemed it. Yeah, it was just awful. So I'm rowing and 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 I'm making ground. And I just have this one buoy that I can see, the entrance buoy, and I'm just aiming for that. It's getting kind of dark now. One fun thing. So while I'm rowing, I'm going in the same general direction, but I'm right on the Canadian-US border line, and the currents are just kind of carrying me in a giant circle. Even though overall, every time the current carries me, I'm making my way the direction I want to go. But it kept crossing me over the border, so I kept getting cell phone service, and my phone would light up with like, where are you going? You're going the wrong way. Are you okay? You know, because everyone was tracking me with this little GPS thing. And so it just looks like a bunch of spirals, but I was making it. I was doing pretty good, and I made it just past the halfway point, and it was like right to the point where, okay, if I just made it in a little bit further, I'd be out of that crazy current, and I could finish up, right? And I could just, even if I had to camp that night, whatever, but I'd be on land. And just as I'm thinking that and like having this moment of like, I did it, I look and there's just a line of container ships as far as I can see. I guess every night they have their like run, and just one after the other, after the other, after the other from the inside passage. And so I like, there's no possible chance I'm going to cross that piece of water anytime soon. And the Canadian Coast Guard showed up.
The Canadian Coast Guard showed up at your boat?
Yeah, they were monitoring the race, and they were like, hey, you're not gonna make it. Do you want us to tow you over? And, you know, if they had towed me, I would have been disqualified. And I was like, no, I'd really rather not. I'll make for San Juan Island. And I kind of pointed, and just the part that I pointed at was just sheer cliff with waves smashing into it and rocks everywhere. And they were like, what? And I was like, yeah, I'll head that way. And they're like, all right, we'll be around if you need us. And I think they gave me their phone number, because I don't remember having to call them over the radio. Just that was my big thing.
The guy gives you a cell phone number. The Canadian Coast Guard's like, all right, buddy, listen, this is my personal cell. All right, son. Just give the call as soon as you will need this.
It was 100% a heart-to-heart of like, hey, when you realize the situation you're in, just give us a call, you know? And I was like, all right, yeah, I'm fine. And also, you know, I'm in the Coast Guard, not that far away from this area, so I know that if I'm over the radio, like, hey, can you come get me? Like, they're going to hear it, and I don't want that, right? They've just granted me approval. It was about five hours.
Did you tell the Canadian Coast Guard you were American Coast Guard?
Not yet. So it was about another hour. It was about 5 hours total of rowing, of being stuck in these currents. Enough that the currents switched at one point, and I couldn't get out of it. I had the sail back up, and I was just slowly getting carried further and further north, away from where I was trying to get to in Victoria. So the sun was fully down. Anyways, at one point, I talked to my dad on the phone, and he was like, hey, what are you doing? Like, just get to land, because they'd been watching me go in circles. So I called the guy's cell phone, and he was like, yeah, we're right next to you. And they were. They were, like, around the corner, basically, waiting. It wasn't just me, too. They had gotten, like I said, 15 boats that day, and they were like, yeah, we'll tow you in. So, all right, great, thank you. I get into their boat, tie off my boat to theirs, and they take off, and the first thing that happens is that their boat's wake fills my boat and sinks it, right? So it sinks it inside while it's still tied, and all my gear is on these floating bags, like floating up. So I jumped off of their boat into my boat to start cutting the gear free so I could get it, and they're freaking out like, hey, you gotta get back in, you gotta get back in. But I'm just so out of it at this point. It's been a long day, and I've been haven't been eating or drinking water. So I'm like, oh, no, it's fine. And they kind of drag me back into their boat, and they let me feel important. They put me in front of the radar, and they're like, hey, because I told them at this point I was in the Coast Guard, because they were going to call CETO. And they said, yeah, we'll call CETO for you and get you in. I was like, man, it's going to cost money. And so
what's CETO?
CETO is commercial rescue, basically. Like, it's not rescue, but it's like, okay, you need to get towed in. You can pay for it.
Yeah.
And so they started saying everything over the radio, and I was like, hey, don't do that over the radio. And they were like, why? And I was like, my work's listening. They'll know. And they were like, what? And I told them, you know, and they pieced it together. And they're like, oh, all right, we'll tow you in, professional courtesy. I was like, yeah, you don't need to do that. And they're like, no. And they did. And so, yeah,
you breezed over the point where you were done. Like, what happened? What made you get to the point where you're like, all right, throwing in the towel?
My option was to head for that cliffside that I'd pointed to in the dark now. Oh, actually, I can tell you exactly what the reason was. when I talked to the guy the first time, he was like, if you can't make it to the side you're heading for, and he was like, which you won't, we see this all the time, like, this is you're not going to make it there, but if you end up going to the San Juan thing, then we're gonna have to pull you out of like waves on rocks, which is like dangerous for them. And like, I just had this kind of like, I don't know, guilt of like, man, this is making it rough on everybody else. That, and then I'm not thrilled about this, but just the constant text messages from people who cared about me, but I wish I just didn't have my phone on. I think that well, it was probably for the best that I did. But anyways, just seeing this, like, just, you know, don't you know, risk your life for this race that you're not in it to win or anything. You're gonna keep going with it. And that was also the biggest deciding factor for me, was if I got towed by them, it wasn't like, I didn't really consider it throwing in the towel. I was like, well, I'm still gonna have to get up tomorrow and keep going. It's not, you know, it's better to keep going with a boat than without a boat, basically. And it seemed at the moment like the option might be wrecking my boat on those rocks and then like surviving the night with all my survival gear. It just seemed stupid to me when there was another option.
Yeah.
You know, so when you went through the rescue swimmer school, I remember kind of a big theme is like, you know, don't ever quit, you know, whatever, you don't ever quit. And I think I keep that in most things I do. I never once regretted or considered that moment quitting. I never thought like, oh, this is throwing in the towel. It just seemed like a reasonable decision. I don't know. If there had been a worthy goal, if they had been like, oh, I need to complete this for something outside of just the fact of completing it, then maybe I would have risked more. But for just doing it, didn't seem worth it. But yeah, they towed me in, gave me a bacon and avocado sandwich, which was delicious. Bought me a beer.
Dude, the Canadian Coast Guard seems like,
oh my god, way better service than what we provided at my station. From then on, I was better at my job for sure, because when we would do a rescue, right, it'd be like, you're just barking orders at these people. You're like, hey, put this on your boat. All right. And then you board them afterwards, and you do, and you're polite during that, but you do a law enforcement boarding to see if they have their safety equipment. And it's just very checklist procedures. And then at this point now, I guess they had rescued me, right? And they were polite, funny, chill, helpful. They were like helping me out with getting out of a hotel room that booked that night, helping me out getting a place at the marina for my stuff. They were just like above and beyond. So definitely from then on, I was better at my job, because I realized you could do that.
Aw, good old Canadians. And in the Canadian Coast Guard, don't they have beards? Like, they're allowed to have a beard?
Yeah, probably. I don't think any of these guys did. But yeah, they're a volunteer.
Oh, yeah.
They're very trained volunteer. So they have like some personal, some kind of like our firefighters. So like, you can be a volunteer firefighter, but you're still a good firefighter.
Yeah.
Yeah. So anyways, the next morning I show up and all my gear is laid out soaking wet because it had sank, right? So all my gear is just there spread out in the middle of this busy marina wharf with people walking around it, this boat spray-painted Virginia there. And I'm like, oh, man.
I thought it sunk. It's still afloat?
Well, it was tied to their boat, so it did sink. So
wait, so they towed it underwater?
Yeah, pretty much, I guess. I don't think we pumped it out. Maybe we tipped it and emptied it.
You can tow a boat that's completely sunk?
No, we must have tipped it and emptied it. I don't remember doing that.
Yeah.
But we must have. Because when it sank, you know, it was tied in side tow to their boat. But as soon as they took off, it filled it with water and just sunk it. I think, I do remember, we did tip it, and then we dragged it onto the back of their boat. So it was just sitting like a giant T on the back of their boat. That was how we ended up bringing it in. And that was why we brought it up onto the pier afterwards.
Gotcha.
To drain out. So anyways, I now have it in my head, like, well, I've got to finish the race. So that day I get in the boat and I'm just around this little marina, all timid and scared, looking out at the water because now I know what the currents are like out there. And every time I'd get near the actual opening, I'd be like, oh, I better practice a little bit more and like turn in. I was terrified. And there were kids out there. There were like children out there, you know, learning to sail, going out there and back because it was a nice day now. It wasn't, you know, like it had been. I did that for 2 days.
Just in and out of the marina?
Yeah, just in the marina. I didn't even go out. I was just in the... It's like a big open area, but it was nice. I mean, it was like sunny and warm and beautiful Canada, and the race wasn't starting for another day anyways.
Oh, this is before the race started?
No, I mean, the race wasn't restarting, so there were a couple of days respite in Victoria, Canada. Yeah. So, oh, this part's kind of cool. I didn't even know it at the time. They had an award ceremony there in Canada, and they, like, everyone got an award, right? They were funny. And so mine was getting the most for your registration money on the first part of the route because I did some crazy number of miles going in giant circles. What I didn't know, so I got that, and so did, like, four other people. And what I didn't know completely, you can see on the map, like the GPS mapping, completely in the exact same circles were five of us, all doing the exact same thing, spread out to where we couldn't see one another. One guy managed to, his circles like carried him into a narrow area, and he camped the night and then walked his like kayak or something. He did just done the first part in a kayak. And then like everyone else got towed in by these boats earlier in the day, and mine was just the longest. Mine went on for an extra like 3 hours after everyone basically. But so we all were in these circles, and then there was just like one going into the distance, and that was mine. But so anyways, the actual race day started again, and it was actually pretty cool. I was a lot more chill at this point. I was like, I don't know, less to prove maybe. But so I just started out, and it was cool. I camped along these little islands for a few days, made it up to the point where the next big crossing would have been. I'd already used up most of my leave time at this point. They're like, yeah, you know, you got to come back. Mm-hmm. And a buddy ended up driving over the ferry with a trailer to get my boat so that I didn't have to sail back. Anyways, we got back. I spent the remainder of my leave in the national park. It was like maybe another week in the national park, just camping out, backcountry camping. And it was cool. All around, it was a good experience.
What did you learn?
Preparation is key. It was a lesson I'd learned before in my life, but still, it was, if I had just gone straight, it wouldn't have been like everything went smooth from there. I would have been fine that day, but then the moment that I started the race again, it would have been bad. So a lot of people got really messed up because the Inside Passage has very specific areas that you need to learn about. Some of it's the currents are so strong, it's like a river, and it caused tidal rapids, and so boats were getting wrecked in storms. There were some helicopter rescues, there were some very dramatic rescues, you know, not just boats being towed in. So the people that made it, first of all, had multiple people in their teams, had the right equipment, they knew the waters.
Yeah.
Other than that, nothing. What? I would do it again.
Well, I think that's certainly like a fun part of your character, is that you do get into these situations because, you know, you're quick to act in a proactive way, right? So like it gets you in these situations that always make for a very entertaining story.
I'll say this. This was kind of cool. That was the last time. It was a big moment for me. I don't know how to describe it, but the entire experience, just kind of undertaking this entire thing alone, that was definitely the first time. I mean, right down to training myself how to do it, I would have done better with people for sure, but it was also kind of cool to see how far I could take this thing alone. And that was sort of the last time that things didn't go super well. Like, that was sort of how I fine-tuned my process for figuring out how to do things well. So, like, when I started flying, my process for getting a pilot's license and flying went very smoothly. When I started doing the scuba diving thing, my process for that went a lot smoother. And I don't know, it was like
the final lesson in what to learn on how to do new things. It was a slap in the face, but it worked.
Well, what would you say you learned as far as your process goes?
I mean, it boils down to what everyone says always about how to do things. Can't take shortcuts. You have to do things right. You can have all the grit in the world, but sheer determination won't outdo ability to complete things, right? So you have to go through all the steps.
That's very true. Yeah, that's actually, we also run the Rescue Swimmer Mindset podcast, which we should have you on to tell your pretty entertaining rescues in the Coast Guard. But yeah, one of the things we talk about is actually just recently was swimming form. And like,
personally, I was one of those that preached that
it was very, it's important to have good technique to make it through swim as challenging as rescue swimmer school.
Yeah, absolutely.
And yeah, like that comes with time, technique, and a proper process. And you know, what's that one thing that they said? Like, yeah, like how do you achieve success? It's with determination, but also proper direction and methodology, right?
Mm-hmm. I think the grit thing is sexier. It gets more attention. People, and probably in every story, because it's true, you do need that, but it won't carry you correctly if all you have is determination. If all you have is determination in the moment, but you don't have determination in the training, then it doesn't matter, right? The real determination is in all the back behind the scenes.
Exactly. Yeah. Like I've always said, like, you know, it's one thing to hit the gym hard once a week or once a month.
Right.
But to me, that's not the same value as just hitting it every day, even on the shitty days that you don't want to go. But at least you go, and you go like those 3 times to 4 times a week. You're going, you know?
Right. Or a 5K. You can say, yeah, I'm going to do this 5K as fast and as hard as I can. And that sounds cool. But what's effective is training for a 5K as hard as you can, and then racing how you train.
Yeah, right on. What do you recommend for anybody that wants to take a 15-foot skiff from Washington to Alaska?
I would say definitely do it. All around enjoyable. I would encourage people to experience that.
Okay. You're the first sailor that we've had on. Can I put sailor in quote? Sailor in quotations.
Yeah. They removed what should that be the title? Rating.
Yeah, what should be the title of this podcast?
Oh, Man Attempt. I think there was a newspaper article that you just steal Man Attempts Inside Passage Alone or something.
Oh, they made a news article.
I think it was a magazine thing from the people that did the race. So for sure. So you kept asking, did they have standards on the race? So the next year they did, because there were like 3/4 of the people were wiped out, and the standards aren't crazy. Like, I could probably, my original crew that I put together with you, if I wrote out those things, that would probably get accepted. But if you're going to be a single submission now, you would probably need to have done at least some documented boating in the past.
Right.
It's still not very, very exceptional, not very difficult to get into.
Well, sorry to let you down, buddy.
It was good for me. Yeah.
You went on your own spiritual journey.
I did. Yeah, that one-eyed sea lion. I'll never forget it.
Yeah, you found your totem animal.
Yeah.
Yep. All right, buddy. The show was sponsored by Cholula.
Cholulu.
Get the green kind, Cholulu. Get the green kind, piment vert, green pepper.
And adopt cats from your local SCPCA.
That's right. Yep. Adopt cats. And yeah, feed it Cholula and you can get as many as you want.
Mm-hmm.
All right, buddy. Cool. We'll have you on the Rescue Swimmer Mindset podcast too. So.
Sounds good. Looking forward to it. Thanks.
Great. Joshua Tuca, World Entertainment Podcast. Follow it on Apple Podcasts. Leave us a rate and review. Helps the podcast grow. We're going to have some good guests in the future. Noel's outdoor educator. So if you wanted to learn about like the environmental impacts of just any kind of outdoor expedition, then tune into that. More wilderness stories to come. All right. World Entertainment Podcast. Tuning out.